Welcome to The Bridge. Fun conversations on culture, life, and everything in between.
Find us where you get your podcasts. If you like the show, then consider pushing the like button or giving us 5 stars. Suggestions, comments, anything you would like to share, email us at welovethebridge@gmail.com. We love The Bridge. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right, Carl Jha is with us today. He is a well-known media commentator in the China sphere. His YouTube and X are at Carl Jha. That's C-A-R-L-Z-H-A, or for you, if you're an American like me, at C-A-R-L-Z-H-A. He is the host of Silk and Steel podcast, a regular guest on RT, CGTN, and other media platforms as well. It's great to talk with you today, man.
Always. Good to see you again.
So in your assessment right now, well, this isn't just economics, but the U.S. global dominance seems to be receding. There was a report that came out yesterday or the day before that showed that people in Southeast Asia are largely saying they would choose China. And that is different from a couple of years ago. So, you know, you're in Southeast Asia. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think for one thing, the gravitational pull of the Chinese economy is very felt very strongly here. For example, here I'm talking with you on the internet that was built by Huawei. Huawei built the 4G network here in Indonesia. The electricity that powers this conversation is provided by Chinese-built power plants north of Bali. I can go on. My Xiaomi phone, which we're recording this conversation on, Chinese-made smartphone affordable to a lot of people in the global south, including Indonesia. Like our nanny has a smartphone. She has a Vivo, I think. And so this is, whereas, you know, if you just compare simply the level of investment that U.S. versus China in Southeast Asia, the Chinese investment in South Asia absolutely dwarfs the U.S. investment into the region. One of the other big projects that China completed recently in Indonesia is the Jakarta-Bandung high-speed railway. I believe you're from California, yes, Jason? And yeah, so we know the story with the California high-speed rail, which we start planning in the early 2000s.
You know, I heard about it. This is interesting to me. I heard about it in the 1990s. I had to write a high school report on it in my like senior year. It was like, oh, find some project and write a report on it. So I found that. I was like, wow, this is really cool. And I presented it to everyone like it was going to be there in a few years. And then I posted that on X. And someone said when their father was doing radio in the 1960s, they were already talking about it. So here it is, like 60 years later, and you know, it's barely even started. But I mean, in that same time, and from 2008 to now, what is it, 45,000 kilometers of high-speed rail? And that's just in China. And as you're pointing out, China is clearly building in Southeast Asia and other places as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is so you know, like the choice is quite clear. You trade with China, you benefit from being integrated with a trade network with China, whereas U.S. presence in Southeast Asia now is primarily military. I mean, the pivot to Asia that started with Obama administration, they're not talking about pivot economically. They're not pivoting investment into Southeast Asia. They're pivoting military deployment and U.S. bases. So this is quite a sharp contrast. The U.S. and Chinese approach to Southeast Asia. Another thing that bears to mention is, where I am in Indonesia, it's a majority Muslim country, and so is Malaysia next door. And, you know, what U.S. is doing supporting Israel in the Middle East is not popular. It's not popular, to say the least, in this part of the world.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, if I were a leader in a nation, I would want trade, economic development. You know, ultimately, even in the United States, they always say it's the economy dummy. And they're talking about, you know, whether an elected leader is going to be able to maintain their place. So if you're an elected leader in Southeast Asia, you're thinking the same thing. I need to grow my economy. What is going to grow my economy? more trade. And that is what China offers. Like you said in our previous interview, China is open for business. You know, I get a lot of people who say, oh, why, you know, if I was the leader of such and such country, I would just trade with China, not the United States. Or if I was the leader of China, I would not trade with the United States. And I think that's actually not China's strategy at all. China is going to trade with anyone. Everyone who wants to buy and sell and trade goods, China is like, okay, we're here. So, I mean, I think that is one of the advantages of doing trade with China is that it is stable, that the relationship of continuing trade is a stable relationship. But I have other questions, lots of other questions. So in your opinion, do other Americans largely seem to understand what is taking place? Because outside of the United States, it seems pretty clear. But in your assessment, I mean, we're both abroad, but you were back recently. Do you think other U.S. Americans are like, oh, this is not going so well? Or are they like, yay, good times?
Well, I mean, let's be real here. Most Americans can't even find Southeast Asia on a map. and most of them are just being led by the nose, by the mainstream media reporting in U.S. And what the mainstream media reporting is China is being aggressive to its neighbors. The U.S. have to commit its territory to guarantee a free and open Indo-Pacific, right? I mean, that's the mainstream media right now. But the reality, of course, is different on the ground. I wanted to add also the Chinese investment in the region is also a different way from, say, for example, U.S. investment. Because there are U.S. investment in Indonesia, but they're mostly focused in the mining sector, like Fremont. They're focused on mining in West Papua and or oil and gas exploration offshore. But China is investing in all arenas. And they're not just interested in natural resource extraction. China is helping to build a nickel factory in Indonesia. So Indonesia is one of the major nickel producing region in the world. So the Indonesian nickel no longer needs to be loaded on ships as raw commodity to be processed in other parts of the world. Now, Indonesia can process their own nickel themselves, which provided the added value. So this is something that China is help with the region that U.S. firms are not.
You know, that's a really interesting point, because I've read that in a few books about how IMF and World Bank failed to develop the underdeveloped world and how this is just replicating models of colonialism. And one of the things that, you know, for people who haven't studied colonialism, one of the things the Europeans and the Americans did is they went in and then they would extract, you know, resources from those countries, bring them back to their own country where they had factories, develop them into finished goods, and then ship them back and sell them to those people for considerable value. But, you know, the kind of infrastructure that China is building around the world, not just in Indonesia, but in other places, is allowing local factory growth. And a lot of the energy projects that China is doing in Africa and in Southeast Asia, Laos, Vietnam, is allowing factory growth to begin to really develop and to flourish. In 2000, the year 2000, Laos had 40% electrification. By 2020, it had 100% electrification. That doesn't just allow people to have refrigerator and TVs, but it also allows them to open factories and to process using local resources to make finished goods and export those for, as you just pointed out, added value. You know, Gina Raimondo, the Commerce Secretary for the U.S., she recently said the U.S. will, quote, do anything to ensure China can't catch up or compete with the U.S. in advanced technology. In your assessment, is that working?
How can you keep one-fifth of humanity down? You know, one in every five person in the world lives in China. And what they're saying is, no, we will not allow you to progress technologically. You know, in fact, we want to roll back of your progress. This is really foolhardy. As you mentioned earlier, China is not, China is focused on its own internal growth. They're not doing this to compete with Americans. They're doing this to make the life better for average Chinese citizens. It's the U.S. that's forcing countries in the world to choose Most of the countries in the region, particularly Southeast Asia, they don't want to have to choose between China and United States. They're perfectly fine to trade with both because, you know, the idea is you can never have too many friends and you don't want to make any enemies, you know, to be friends of all and to be enemy of none. And that's a very sensible policy. But U.S. got this bug of us, you know, have to maintain the U.S. supremacy over the world at no matter the cost. That's forcing people to choose, you know, you're either with me or against me. It's my way or the highway. And, you know, that doesn't play well in today's world. We're now no longer living the post-Cold War, you know, the U.S. hyperpower unipolar moment anymore. We're living a multipolar world. People have more choice. You know, one of the things with rise of China is giving people choices, giving people alternatives, so they don't always have to rely on IMF and World Bank loans. Now there's China offering loans, so people can pick and choose. And, you know, what U.S. wants to do is taking that option away for people. I mean, the choice is quite simple. You know, this is why many people would rather side with China in this approach. You know, they're not necessarily siding with China. They're siding with their own, you know, own best interests.
In terms of Chinese technological advancements, do you think that China is still behind the curve of the United States? And a lot of people accuse China of copying U.S. technologies, or is China, how would you describe China's relationship to advanced technology right now?
Oh, right. Okay. So that actually goes back to your question about Gina Raimondo. And the chip sanction that was specifically targeting Huawei by the broad range of Chinese tech sector. That was to, we saw Huawei make their chip breakthrough just recently. You know, it was quite a shock to many U.S. decision makers that China is now able to manufacture 7-nanometer chips. They thought, okay, you know, China would be lucky if they get to 14 nanometers, and no way they're going to make it 7 nanometers because U.S. has already taken all the tool sets away. Everyone's surprised. China is developing their own method, their own tool sets. And the Gina Raimondo approach is, you know, this is because our sanction is working. It's because our sanction is not broad enough. So we're going to expand the sanctions. I mean, this is basically, this reminds me what Joe Biden said about the U.S. bombing campaign in Yemen. And he said, is the U.S. bombing helping to break the blockade of Red Sea? No. Are we going to stop doing it? No. I mean, basically, this is U.S. approach right now. The sanction is not working, but they're going to do it anyway. I'm going to further expand sanctions. Sanctions is counterproductive because prior to the U.S. tech sanction on China, China actually was dependent on chip import. China spent average about $400 billion on chip imports, which means China has spent more on chip import than they spent on importing oil. And that dependency was growing year after year as the Chinese economy itself was growing. So in fact, you know, China's dependency on the U.S. tech sector was growing. And yet U.S., the bright genius from the U.S. Commerce Department and, you know, all the Pentagon and all the Washington dickheads, they thought, aha, we saw this weakest link. Well, you know what? We're going to snip this part of the supply chain. We're going to force Chinese back to the Stone Ages. But what has happened instead is it pointed out for China, you know, what their, you know, vulnerability is in their supply chain. And, you know, even though people has pointed out, oh, but Chinese government has spent decades trying to foster its own indigenous semiconductor industry, but has always lagged behind the West, you know, many generations behind. So how would their latest effort, you know, be any different? But the difference is the U.S. sanction. You know, before the U.S. sanction, firms like Huawei, they can easily go purchase Qualcomm chips. They can go to TSMC on Taiwan to manufacture their own chips. But there's no reason. In other words, the Chinese commercial firms, they have no reason to work with the domestic Chinese chip manufacturers, especially when the domestic Chinese manufacturers are usually 3, 4, 5 generations behind their Western counterparts. The private Chinese companies, their goal is to rush out a good product that Chinese consumer would buy. You know, they don't care if the components will come from US, from Japan, from Korea, from Netherlands. They just want to get the best of its class, put it into their product, and then so to sell their product at a quality and a price that the consumer would purchase. But now the U.S. sanction is to tell all the Chinese tech companies, like, it's basically hanging a sword on the top of all Chinese tech companies, that you know what? We can cut you off at any time of this very vital part of your supply chain and force your companies to close. I mean, for a while, Huawei's phone business, handset business, almost got wiped out because of the chip sanctions. You know, but when I first came to Bali, for example, you will see Huawei everywhere in store. But for a couple of years after the sanction, like, the old Huawei phone just disappeared. There's still other Chinese brands who are not under sanction, like Vivo, Oppo, and Xiaomi. But Huawei phone was gone. And inside China, Apple basically cannibalized all the Huawei market share. But that is a huge alarm bell to all other Chinese tech companies. Like, we can be the next Huawei if we grew to the point that will catch the attention of the U.S. State Department. And also for Huawei, they have no choice. They have to go domestic route. Now they have to work with SMIC, the domestic Chinese producer of semiconductors. So now it kind of, for the first time, the Chinese private industry and the Chinese government objective are perfectly in a line. This was forced upon by the U.S. sanctions. And now what we saw is that because it's such an existential issue for the Chinese tech industry, it's a do or die situation. And this is the situation that fosters innovation. And SMIC was able to pull it off by making the 7-nanometer chip for Huawei under heavy sanctions. Of course, you know, obviously, sanction is not working. Huawei has roared back with their new phone, and they took back all their market share from Apple in China. But, you know, Gina Raimondo method is, you know what? Okay, maybe there's some loophole in our sanctions. We got to tighten it even more and expand more sanctions against any suppliers to Huawei. Again, this is just going to force China to work more tightly together with each other, making everybody to work faster, harder. China graduated 1.7 million engineers in 2023, versus I think it was like 500,000 in U.S. There's no competition. I mean, like, in terms of tech nowadays, there's nothing you cannot solve by throwing bunch of people and shit tons of money. I mean, and give it time, things will happen. I mean, that's what China is doing right now. China has already ramped up the domestic semiconductor manufacturing, especially in the low and mid end. What people don't, you know, people right now is focused on TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductors, which manufacture most of the world's advanced chip. But the vast majority of the chip market is still in the low to mid end chips, that because now that we use chips in everything, in refrigerators, in cars, and now China is able to manufacture everything from low to medium range of the chips up to all the way to 7-nanometer. The effect of the U.S. sanction is such that if Chinese company have a choice, they will go domestic. because you know they gotta have a guarantee that it won't be cut off. So what that means is this $400 billion chip market. China is still the world's largest market for semiconductors. Yeah, so that means all this market that's as soon as they go Chinese,
Germany, Sweden, Japan, United States, Taiwan province, all cut off from the largest importer of chips in the world by their own choice.
Yeah.
And so now China will be completely self-reliant in the future. In 5 years, all of these companies will have redundant manufacturing because China is the largest exporter of electronic devices. Like you mentioned, coffee machines and televisions and all these things that use these chips. And if they don't need to import them anymore, which is the United States is forcing them not to, it's just ridiculous. It really frustrates me that, you know, in addition to the fact that the United States is ultimately hurting itself and its allies long term, another thing that really frustrates me is that the United States is throwing away goodwill. You know, the deeper we have economic relations with China, the better our, you know, the whole world is going to be moving forward. This is the most important economic and you know, political relationship in the world. If we can have good relations, that's good for global peace. That's good for everyone. And so the United States is constantly like, what can we do to try to, you know, screw over China? But then China is just like, okay, we'll just do that ourselves then. Like, it's just, it really is just bizarre watching like Gina Raimondo and that kind of thinking. You know, why are these people given the ability to do these things? Doesn't she have people around her warning her of the potential consequences? Because it seems pretty obvious to a lot of people.
That's the thing. I think there's a cutoff between the people who stuck in the Beltway bubble and the people who actually work in the industry. Because right now, a lot of the Chinese tech companies are telling Washington, stop doing this. You're killing our future business. I mean, even like the tech firm that's on the top of the world right now, like NVIDIA, you know, NVIDIA, their biggest market is in China. And US is telling NVIDIA, no, you have to cut off your top AI chips to China. And they're all these US tech companies are saying, you're killing us. What the hell? You don't know what you're doing. And like I said, these China is the world's largest market for semiconductors. Once China achieves self-sufficiency, you know, once the consumers of chips goes Chinese, they're not never coming back. They're not coming back to source their components from U.S. companies ever again, because for the fear that they might get cut off. And as you mentioned, you know, Chinese, like a lot of the high-tech Chinese firm, like Huawei, for example, the CEO, founder and CEO of Huawei, Zhen Zhenfei, he was a big lover of the United States. He was a big admirer of the United States. You know, same goes for the founder of ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok. But U.S. government is forcing them to with a reality, with the sanctions, like, oh, yeah, you love us, but guess what? We have to screw you because we want to be number one. And this is completely misguided because China, there's no reason China and U.S. cannot coexist and prosper together. But again, it's a kind of the mentality of Washington elite that somehow U.S. have to be number one no matter what. You know, like they want to, you know, even roll back the progress for one fifth of humanity, and the fact it's a self-defeating policy, and it not just hurts Chinese, but it hurts American as well. It hurts the bottom line of the American companies that's selling to China. You know, many ways GM sells more cars to China than they sell in United States, and the U.S. the effect of the U.S. sanction is that GM factories in China producing cars for the Chinese market, they cannot buy semiconductors from China to make cars they sell in China because of U.S. sanctions. This is completely ridiculous. Oh, yeah.
You're listening to The Bridge.
Well, Well, you know, I kind of wanted to go a little deeper into that. And one of the things that I've been noticing, I think this is becoming a trend for people to really point out is, yeah, the United States has historically, the last few decades from the 60s and 70s, had the largest consumer base in the world, the largest amount of people buying things. And so a lot of people were like, we need to access the American market because they have lots of people who are willing to buy our products. So if you're a business person in Europe, you're a business person in Asia, it doesn't matter. You want to get into the American market. And so that has been one of the reasons the U.S. economy has been so strong for so long. But now it looks like, if you look at the statistics, you have 135 million middle-class Americans, but you have 400 or 500 million, you know, middle-class Chinese consumers. And that's growing. You know, as the GDP of China increases, disposable income by purchasing power parity, or however you want to measure it, is also increasing. So in your assessment, you know, down the line in 5 or 10 years, or even, you know, next year, do you think that, and the companies in the United States may end up regretting damaging Sino-US relations, because ultimately China's going to have a consumer economy that's 3 or 4 times larger than that in the United States?
Well, I mean, US companies are regretting right now. This is not their policy. They're the one to continue to do business with China. It's just big heads in Washington that decide to impose the sanctions. Most of the US companies are against it. And you know, the only ones who are not affected are the U.S. companies that do not have a business presence in China, where I'm talking about Facebook and Google. And those companies are also aligned trying to kill off TikTok in U.S. right now, because TikTok is their major competitor. and it's crazy what U.S. government is trying to do. They're basically essentially trying to build a wall around U.S. and also its ally, so-called ally, but really vassal states in Europe. And they're trying to divide the world into two blocks again. You know, basically, they're bringing back the Cold War. I think in their mind, their thinking is, okay, we know how Cold War 1.0 played out. You know, you have the Soviet bloc, and then you have the Western bloc, and we won. We won Cold War 1.0. So we can do it again. But the time is different. I mean, China is a manufacturing center of the world. China is a factory of the world. When you're trying to cut off China, you're not just, what you're really doing, you're cutting yourself off from the world. Because China will continue to make goods not only for people in China, but all over global South countries and all over the emerging economies. So we're already seeing the effect of that. You know, we can look at the areas, for example, when U.S. applied sanctions against Huawei. You know, U.S. is still struggling with 5G. And China is already ready to move on with 6G. And so what's more likely, and also China is rolling out you know, their sustainable energy and also with EV.
By the way, in terms of 5G, this is a 5.5G portable hotspot that I could get from Huawei. So I already have 5.5 in China.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing works like if I go to the Himalayas, I'll be standing on the mountain. I've got 5.5G. In the United States, they still have like 3G, 4G levels in some of the remote parts of the country. That is not the case here.
Yep.
But yeah, in terms of solar and wind, and all the green energy, it is so shocking how fast it's going. I mean, I have been a proponent of China's move towards green energy for many years, but I was surprised by 2023. It was shocking how much they actually rolled out. And a lot of people are like, oh, it's intermittent, but China has so many new tools, just amazing, like new technologies like gravity storage, like where they just move boulders up and down in these huge towers, and water up and down streams and all kinds of stuff to maintain electrification all the time, in addition to the fact that there's still a mix of fossil fuels in with everything, and nuclear is going. I mean, China's economy, one of the main drivers in 2023 was rolling out all of these renewable energies. And China's technology is clearly, you know, really advanced. China now has the fastest high-speed rail line in the world. And maglev is actually becoming a reality very soon, according to some friends of mine. So it's just amazing to see that the United States is like, oh, we'll just cut China off from this technology. what are you talking about? The United States is like a museum of 20th century artifacts. I mean, in many ways, China has already outpaced the United States in most important technologies. Yes, there are some, you know, critical technologies the United States is ahead in. But if the United States just cuts China off, China will just make those anyways. So it's really bizarre to see this kind of strategy instead of, hey, China's the next big thing. Let's be buddies with them. That would, in my opinion, as an American, that makes a lot more sense. I mean, that's what the UK did. They were like, oh, wow, the United States is the next big thing. We're buddies, you know, you and me. You know, like, that's what the United States should be doing with China, in my assessment.
Well, I think one of the problem is nowadays very few Americans they travel to China. You know, very few Americans speak Chinese. Very few American has, you know, ever set foot on China, and so their idea of China is not actually the country itself. Their idea of China is existing a bizarro world that's constructed by their media. And the problem is that I have a feeling the elite in the Beltway, they start to imbibe in their own propaganda. their idea of the world is totally warped, and they probably don't even realize you know, how far ahead China is at this point. They still think, you know, Washington can push its weight around.
Well, I wanted to ask you, what are your opinions about de-dollarization? I love to ask people, especially like people like you who know about this, like, is there going to be an inflection point? And what are the potential consequences for the dollar if the U.S. keeps increasing debt levels at the speed that it is now? And countries, you know, even slowly migrate to other currencies.
Well, I mean, people have been talking about de-dollarization for decades, but the real big inflection point, I think, was the sanction, the Russian sanction, because prior to that, you know, like everybody knows there's a need to move away from the dollar, but it's just so convenient. You know, people have realized the importance to moving away from dollar for a long time. But the dollar is so convenient because you can use it everywhere. Everybody accepts it. There's not, you know, the pro overweighs the cons. However, with a very drastic Russian sanction, that's what made people set up and take notice. Like, holy crap, you know, not only you can cut off a country off completely, but you actually can take their money. You know, then when it froze your Russian asset in dollars.
And now Yellen wants to give that to other countries.
Yes, yes, that's robbery. That's right. I mean, that they did that with Afghanistan too, by the way.
And, yeah, it was 9 billion, I think.
Yeah, and this is quite obscene. You know, Afghanistan, one of the poorest countries in the world, and you're taking their money away. So this is for Russia, again, they had no choice. They had to move off the dollar platform because that's a U.S. government policy. So again, you know, U.S. policy, I mean, a lot of the diplomatic setbacks that the U.S. is facing right now is mostly self-inflicted. Like, U.S. government policy literally pushed forward the momentum for de-dollarization. And this is when country of the BRICS said, okay, well, now maybe it's time for us to talk about forming a BRICS currency. And this is really important because once upon a time, U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency makes sense because after World War II, U.S. is one of the few countries that was not devastated. In 1950, U.S. composed about 50% of the world GDP. And you know, U.S. was the manufacturing power of the world in a similar way that China is today. But U.S. Wall Street type have intentionally hollowed out the U.S. manufacturing capability since the 1970s. And then U.S. economy is now increasingly financialized. Itself relies on the hegemony of the dollar. And yet, all the U.S. sanctions are counterproductive to maintain the dollar hegemony. It forces people to think of alternatives. And there are plenty of alternatives because, you know, one of the pillars of dollar hegemony is a petrodollar. Kissinger went to Saudi Arabia back in the 70s and like, okay, let's work out a deal. U.S. will provide security. In return, you got to price your oil export in dollars. That basically forced everybody to take dollars because you need dollars to purchase oil. Nowadays, you know, Saudi Arabia's largest export market is China. And there's really not much compelling reason for Saudi Arabia, for example, for the Saudi-China trade to be conducted in dollars. It could very easily be conducted in yuan because China makes all the manufacturing goods. China imports oil from Saudi Arabia, and it makes sense. You can just use the Chinese RMB to buy Chinese-made goods. And this same dynamic is happening all over the world. At the same time, the U.S. is sabotaging its own dollar hegemony by slapping sanctions left and right. Like Marco Rubio said, in other 5 years, we won't be able to sanction anybody anymore because they won't be using dollars. For some reason, they don't make the connection. It's like it's a sanction itself that's forcing people off the dollars.
Yeah, it's not just Russia or Saudi. It's like half dozens of countries around the world, individuals around the world, companies around the world. The United States is slowly, like you said, creating the conditions itself for individuals and companies and countries to say, well, I guess we can't use the dollar anymore because the United States made it impossible. So yeah, it definitely is contributing to that. And yeah, I would say that is a really good point. That is an inflection point with what the United States did to Russia. I wanted to ask you about the Chinese economy because, okay, forgive me if I'm wrong, but China's economy grew by 5.2% last year. And the United States economy grew by 2.5% last year. But the United States was like, woo, we've got the fastest growing economy. I'm sorry, what happened? What did I miss? Is China's economy suffering? Like, what is going on here?
This is like that meme, Jason, like the guy celebrating with his big trophy, and then you zoom out and he was on the bottom of the ladder. That's the United States. Yeah, that's the United States right now. And instead, in the mainstream media, we're celebrating the win of 2.5 economic growth. You know, finally, U.S. achieved the amazing growth under Bidenomics while China is growing twice as fast. But China is supposedly collapsing. You know, it's the end of the Chinese miracle. China is falling. And what people don't realize is that there is a slowdown in growth in the Chinese economy. But that's a slowdown in growth. Chinese economy is still growing. It's just not growing as fast as before. And this is also because Chinese economy is going through transition. It's transitioning away from real estate investment growth to more growth in areas like high-tech manufacturing. Which is actually positive in the long and medium term. And there will be some pain in the short term because of the transition, but it's actually healthy, you know, rather than plowing all this money and resources into build more houses when the population is declining, it makes sense to be investing in automation, robotics, AI, et cetera. And China is already reaping benefits of investment into these areas. It's like, again, I think a lot of it is political because, you know, U.S. is facing it's another election year, and now you have all these Democratic Party toadies, you know, including even Paul Krugman. Paul Krugman is writing articles like, "Oh, Bidenomics is working and it's making China angry and it's okay." It's like, what are you talking about? China doesn't care about Bidenomics. You know, China only cares that, you know, about the U.S. sanctions. This is one area where U.S. is still leading the world, copium production. I mean, this is what we're seeing right now. We're seeing like the copium production off the charts as U.S. is steadily losing its top spot in the world economy. It's sad to say because As a U.S. passport holder, I would rather, you know, U.S. come to grip with the reality and work with China. And so both countries and people in both countries can march toward prosperity together. You know, this is what Chinese leaders talk about. You know, Xi Jinping talk about the common destiny of the mankind, but in Washington, all they talk about is, you know, we gotta crush these upstarts. You know, we gotta crush Russia, China, Iran, and it's quite a stark contrast, you know, between the politicians but the difference is in China. The Chinese leadership to plan for long term. You know, they have the 5-year plans. In United States, everything is geared towards the short election cycle.
Yeah. Can I get reelected? What do I need to do right now to get elected? And that might not always even be in the best interest of the population. It's just that is what's going to get make me popular for 6 months, just for the right window so I can get reelected, even if it's not necessarily the best thing for the people. I want, you know, and it also, in terms of the Belt and Road, because I want to ask you about BRICS. In terms of the Belt and Road, you know, China has been investing in the infrastructure, in the development of these underdeveloped world that has been left out of development, not just since World War II, but during the entire colonial phase for the last several hundred years, as the Europeans and the Americans extracted all this wealth from these places, and they literally became poorer than they were. I mean, what the UK did to India is just probably one of the most profound examples of that, but happened all over the world. And in China too, in Africa, human beings were taken and sent to other continents as slaves and so forth. But the Belt and Road is going in, it's building, you know, bridges, it's building ports, it's building roads, it's building hospitals, it's building energy infrastructure, you know, transition lines for electricity from everything that a country needs to really develop. And one of the things I've noticed is that while China is maintained, you know, the number one trading partner with most European countries and almost with the United States, and actually through the United States, through Mexico, China's actual trade is increasing as a percentage is in the developing world. So as a larger percentage of China's, you know, economic growth engine, that is starting to take place in the developing world, which is gigantic. And, you know, if we're talking about the United States, like, they don't have a long-term strategy, like you said, because they're not doing that. They're not engaging in that same way. They're just going in and saying, you have to choose us or you have to choose China. Which one are you going to choose? And then the governments are usually like, we're not making that choice. Like, we'd rather just trade with everyone. You know, one of the things I don't understand always is BRICS. Like, BRICS is obviously working on another currency, and it does bring countries together. And a lot of people, when I point out how much I love the Belt and Road, they're like, oh, but I love BRICS. What am I missing? What does BRICS do, or what can it do to create a better multipolar world for the members and for others?
Well, first of all, BRICS is an economic alliance. It's not a security alliance like NATO. This BRICS is just a forum. I mean, originally BRICS was an acronym that was coined by Goldman Sachs, right? it was a marketing gimmick, but it actually come to fruition as the head of these countries actually sat down, you know, let's talk and let's have a forum for economic cooperation. And if you look at the countries that's looking to join BRICS, that list is expanding. Because as you mentioned, BRICS is kind of seen as a pole that's not representing the old paradigm of the Euro-American economic dominance over the world. Because what BRICS represents is it's representing the emergence of the global South countries. And you know, what one of the things it's interesting, you know, if you talk about kind of the fear of the BRICS and fear of Belt and Road in United States, I vividly remember an interview, recent interview by Tucker Carlson, and he's saying, okay, look at all these, look at our colonies in Latin America. China is building infrastructures. Why the hell is China building roads and ports and power plant in these places? What is their real true motive? It's like, you know, that conversation really says a lot. I mean, because they really see this. So the question should really be asked, why didn't America provide the infrastructure and went in to build the economic engagement the way that China has done? In a way, China is stepping into a vacuum because there was need for infrastructure, there was need for economic development, But these things weren't seen as profitable venues for many of the multinationals. You know, they're not interested in those things. Whereas China is investing for long term because they understand if they build the roads, build the ports, build the infrastructure, that increase the trade. And with the rising profile of China as emergence as the global trading nation, that benefits China because, you know, China can sell more products and services.
You make your neighbor wealthy, then you can sell them things because they have money. I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
But that's not how U.S. companies work, because U.S. companies focus on the quarter earning reports. They're trying to make it look good for this quarter so their stocks can go up. And again, it's the same short-term thinking as the U.S. politicians. I think this is why a lot of the people in the global South have high hope for the BRICS. They're tired of the same old IMF and World Bank domination of their economy, the real debt traps. And they're looking for alternatives.
Well, I have a two-part question. The first part is, are we already in a multipolar world now? Or is that something that we're going to come to?
Well, I will quote someone far more knowledgeable and far more qualified than I am. That's U.S. professor John Mearsheimer. He was asked the same question recently, and he said, yes, we're in a multipolar world right now. I think that's obvious. You know, U.S. is waging a proxy war against Russia in Ukraine at the moment, and it's not winning. Despite the $1 trillion spending on the military budget, despite the combined might of NATO, the Russian industrial production is outproducing all of them right now. I mean, again, it kind of showed when measuring your GDP in nominal dollars sometimes does not reflect the real strength of your economy. You know, you can have a $1 trillion military budget, but what does that really get you? It's obvious, apparently it's not getting you the 155-millimeter artillery shell that Ukraine needs, because U.S. has decided to phase out artillery shell production because there was not too much profit in it. You know, the U.S. military industrial complex find more profit, more margins, and more kickbacks in high-tech boondoggles like F-35. You know, there's more grease for all around than really mundane stuff like artillery shell production. So, but yet they can't, you know, ramp it up fast enough just to feed the war machine in Ukraine. Then you have what U.S. is U.S. fullbacking of Israel in Palestine. This is cratering the U.S. soft power all over the globe right now.
The United States images never look so bad. I mean, I was one of those people in 2003, 2004 saying, this war in Iraq is illegal, but it didn't destroy the U.S. image abroad, even though it did for a lot of people, for millions of people it did. But there's nothing like this ever in my lifetime that has affected the U.S. image abroad as bad as the United States military support for ongoing war crimes.
You know, back in 2003, people can still make the excuse, oh, that's just George W. Bush. You know, he's one-time wacko, right? And now they even have rehabilitated George. The U.S. mainstream media has rehabilitated George W. Bush because during the Trump presidency, you know, just because Bush wasn't, was against Trump. So, I mean, like now we're at Biden, there's no more excuse. And we are in the internet age now. It's a lot harder for Washington to control the narrative to just like domination of the airwave on TV. People now get their news on the internet. They can log on X. They can see in real time what's going on.
Everyone's got phones and video cameras everywhere in every country, even in the underdeveloped world. So, yeah. I mean, and it's the things that are being destroyed. You know, when the United States accidentally bombed a hospital in Afghanistan, you heard about that. I mean, people were like, oh, you know, it was an accident or whatever. The Pentagon, but now it's just like constantly hospital. Okay, this is not an accident.
Yeah, the recent killing of the WCK, the World's Kitchen, the UN aid worker, people can see the videos of them providing food for Palestinians one moment, and the next moment you saw their bodies laying out. I mean, that is has a huge emotional impact. And so U.S. is very fastly depleting its prestige, its soft power it has built up since since World War II. And now it's trying. I think this is one of the reasons why in the recent survey that shows most of the Southeast nations would rather side with China than with the United States, because they can see what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in the Middle East. And they saw that U.S. is, in fact, not a force for stability. In fact, U.S. is destabilizing all across the world. And they rather just trade with China and be left alone. And this is one thing that I wish sensible U.S. decision makers, you know, could take a page from China's non-interference policy. U.S. has incredible resources. You know, it's blessed with your geographic location being bounded by two oceans. Its homeland is incredibly secure. If U.S. just focuses on own internal development, the possibility is limitless. I mean, United States still one of the world's richest countries. I mean, it has a lot of resources, yet it decides to blow everything away in wars across the world, which makes it incredibly unpopular. So, yeah, we are definitely a multi-world today.
Well, I mean, my next question, I think you answered. My last question for you was going to be, what better policy should the U.S. pursue than the policies that it seems to be pursuing now? And I think what you've said is basically, you know, the United States should engage in helping develop countries around the world, develop markets around the world, stop destabilizing other countries, protect its, you know, develop itself. You know, I agree. I think I'm a U.S. citizen. I think we waste too much on the military. Now, and not that we don't need it. I also don't think we need to mothball our military. I think we just need to, you know, we have, 851 bases abroad, something like that. I'm okay with having 50 abroad, you know, like just critical locations to refuel things and stuff. Bring everyone else home. Let's rebuild our economy. Let's build some rail. Let's, you know, educate our kids better. Let's help people pay for school. Let's, you know, for people who are out of work, let's give them technical skills and, you know, do what China has done with its poverty alleviation. I know that the poverty lines are different, but we could still help our poor people anyway without, you know, saying, oh, well, our poverty line's much higher. There's nothing we can do about it. You know, we have like 1 million homeless people. They say it's 650,000. Everyone knows those numbers are fudged. And, you know, if we spent more of our resources developing ourselves, educating ourselves, and helping other developing countries, you know, not only would we have goodwill, we would have better trade, and it would be a better long-term strategy. Would you like to add anything to that? Last thoughts?
I agree. Just gave up the empire. I mean, you just gave up the empire and developed a republic. That's what make U.S. a much greater. I mean, be the shining city on the hill by example, not by trying to impose your proxies into the peoples of the world. People don't like that. I think U.S. just cut out all the foreign interventions. That fact by itself would kind of boost the U.S. prestige by quite a bit, because U.S. still have quite a bit of a soft powers through like Hollywood and stuff like that.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for your time, Carl Jha. You can find Carl Jha on X and on YouTube at Carl Jha, C-A-R-L-Z-H-A. All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jason.